says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, a woman and the kids and the dogs and me. Got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those winning moan boys raised on shotguns. From the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the Western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Well, there we go with Hank Williams Jr. I want to tell you something. I took that off YouTube, and it was a music video in black and white. It showed all people out in the countryside. Every one of them were white. Hank Williams didn't have one black person in that music video. How about that? White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker right here next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse. And right next to our filling station, where we serve you Ethel or regular anytime, 24 hours a day, man. And that's right next to our weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard, where we bring them in from all over the world. We have to sneak them in. Sometimes we have to get some strange people to bring them in, but we get them in here. We epoxy up the bullet holes and paint them up, pound them out. And you come on down here in the summer, and we're running out of summer, that's for sure. We're into fall. If you're going to come down here and get one of these big late model half tracks and the bulletproof big babies, we don't sell the little stuff. Well, you're going to have to get down here with your 18-wheeler. But make sure you pull off the side of the road down here in front of my place so my neighbors can get through, okay? We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations, your snail mail, your suggestions, your bitches, your gripes, your congratulations, or whatever you want to send. That's the place to send it. And we'll look it over. And if we think it makes sense, we'll vote for it. If not, then we won't. How about that? Because I'm telling you, we got a regular hee-haw radio station here. And if you'd see it, you'd understand. I got flypaper hanging down here in front of my monitor, a little off to the side so I can see the monitor. I got cobwebs in the ceiling. I got the ceiling half soundproofed and half not, so it's quite a deal down here. But I want to tell you, if the tornadoes and the hurricanes come, I'm going to be right down here and feel real safe. Yeah, I can live down here. Yeah, I can. Yeah. Well, I'm doing the show a little bit later today because Wednesday, third Wednesday of every month, mainly during the summer and fall, our senior class, our 1956 class, gets together for lunch. And we trade lies and things like that. And, you know, we talk about all the things we got on each other, what we know they did. They deny it back in the day. And so, I don't know whether you do that where you're from or not. But it sort of caught on back here, and there's several other years in the 50s and 60s now. They're having once a month luncheons, too. I think that's good, because slowly dropping by the wayside, man. We're losing them. But there's still a lot of us left. Yeah. Well, how's the wars going? We got wars everywhere, man, and they're starting new ones all the time because they're going to go down in there in Somalia and Nigeria because there's oil down there and stuff, and there's always something you can steal off the people. And, I mean, you know how we feel about black and white separation, but on the other hand, we don't believe in suppressing people in other countries, in black countries or anything else. We just want separation, and we're just as much the enemy of these big corporations that go all over the world screwing people, no matter what color they are. So just remember that, Mr. Corporation Man, you big old CEO, we're watching you. Yeah, and you ain't going to get away with it forever. I'm going to write a book about flies, man, because they're strange. Yesterday, I was in here in the bunker, and the flies were bothering me. I had two or three of them I just couldn't get rid of. I finally had to put the fly strip up here right on the console, and now come back today. Now, the weather's not that much different, more rain outside, but there's not a fly in sight. I don't know what the hell's the story with flies. I think somebody should write a book about the natural lives of flies, man. Well, let's go back to class, boys and girls. I know sometimes it might get a little boring, but we're going to do it anyhow, because sometimes when I just send you something to read, I don't think a lot of people get time to read it. So when I got you as a captive audience here, I'll get my chair up to the console here and read you some stuff. And this is from my good friend when he was alive, David McCallum. He was a lone wolf, just like I am mostly, and I mean, we didn't hang out all the time or anything like that, but I knew him when he was running the Institute for Hysterical Review out there in California. and we agreed on a lot of things. Once in a while we had arguments, so I'll say that, but he was an honest guy. He was from Northern England, and in other words, the part that was still connected with the Brits. And he died a young man, really. And now they said he died of AIDS, but I talked to his wife, and she didn't think that was it at all. And you can get AIDS in other ways besides just shooting yourself in the arm or sex. But anyhow, he contributed a great thing to the struggle, and that was his mini book, and that was Exiles from History. Now, if you haven't read Exiles from History, you should get it and keep it in your library. If not for you, for other people, your kids. And but today we're going to go through some of it, because he does more in a few pages than most guys can do with 500 pages. 40 pages. His whole booklet was 40 pages. I was always amazed how he boiled it down. Let me see here. Okay. Introduction. There are many who will dismiss this book as anti-Semitic. Oh, come on. Some without even reading it. Others have already pointed out that the term anti-Semitic is a misnomer, since the Arabs are Semites and the Ashkenazi Jews are not. But leaving aside this etymological point, I would reply to such critics that most of my sources and references are Jewish. The commentary laced in between the quotations is totally my own, and I do not have an anti-Semitic bone in my body. Maybe an anti-Jewish bone, I don't know. In any case, why is that nowadays one can usually proffer criticism of any social group, Protestants, Catholics, Poles, Mexicans, even blacks, except for the Jewish group? To describe or even to criticize any group's behavior patterns is not the same as wishing to destroy that group. For anyone to immediately jump to that conclusion, particularly if they are a member of that group themselves, suggests that there is indeed a profound psychosocial and psychohistorical phenomenon in play. A social and psychological phenomenon which causes people to react in such a bizarre, paranoid manner is sorely in need of rigorous examination. Such reactions, in fact, become a part of the study. Then there are others who will dismiss this study as the product of an unqualified author. My reply must be that if the qualified academics fail in their duty to examine all areas of society and history, then it's up to the layman to do it instead. When historians failed to apply the same critique to the Holocaust, which they applied to other historical events, then amateurs and academics then there are others who will dismiss this study as a product of an unqualified author. Wait a minute. That's paragraph. Two paragraphs are the same. Well, I'm going to go down here a ways then. Research must not be allowed to fail by default. Our horizons of knowledge must be forever widened. The history of progress tells us that advances are often made by dissenters. Very often, amateur dissenters in medieval times, dissenters in astronomy, were persecuted. In Victorian Britain, Charles Darwin was laughed at. It is sad but true that academics often behave like priests. Theory is only qualified if it has been approved, blessed, and ordained by the high priest of knowledge, the academics. And any theory which deviates from the priest's dogma is shunned, regardless of its content or value. Particularly in the field known as the humanities, there is also a tendency for the academics to turn inward and develop an exclusive jargon and a mystique with which to baffle and therefore impress outsiders. Once in a while, one of the club members will rebel against the authority of the group and will publicly condemn the operation of this in-crowd syndrome and all the intellectual constipation that goes with it. But often as not, one dogma will simply be replaced by another, just as Martin Luther rebelled against the dogma of the Catholic Church only to replace it with another kind of dogma. Sometimes history throws up egotistical, eccentric individualists who delight in bursting the dogmatist's overinflated sense of their own self-importance. The muckraker, Henry L. Mencken, was certainly one. So too is today's Tom Wolfe, who takes literary swipes at artists, politicians, philanthropists, and architects with one biting satire after another. The iconoclastic scholar Henry Elmer Barnes was qualified in many areas, but he also put forward radical theories in peripheral subjects, and it is largely thanks to Barnes' inspiration that the revisionist movement of history is so much in the news today. This was written back in the 80s, of course. The psychohistory movement today is part of the academic parlay. The editor of the Journal of Psychohistory is a layman, but most of his contributors are academics in the field of psychology. Speakers at psychohistory conventions come from all walks of life. My introduction to the field came while I was working as director of the Institute for Historical Review at Torrance, California, near Los Angeles. Although I had initially been recruited as an editor for the Noontide Press, a conservative book publishing house, I suggested to the proprietors that a revisionist history institute would be a most timely venture. The suggestion was taken up with great enthusiasm, and I was to be the director of the IHR from its inception. In late 1978, until my departure at the end of April 1981, a supporter first drew my attention to the Institute of Psychohistory and its publications. I was immediately fascinated by its work. My only previous encounter with the term was in Isaac Simonov's science fiction Foundation Trilogy. I developed an exchange of publications and correspondence with the IFP director, Lloyd D. Mouse, and one of their prominent contributors, Dr. Howard F. Stein, who is a professor at the University of Oklahoma. I was greatly impressed with the sincerity, intellectual integrity, and intelligence of these two men. I was particularly struck by the intellectual and physical courage it took for the fall 1978 issue of the Journal of Psychohistory to be themed on the explosive topic of Judaism as a group fantasy. A brilliant article therein by Dr. Stein inspired me to invite him to contribute a similar piece to the Journal for Historical Review, and this was duly published in the winter of 1980 issue. I've made extensive use of both Stein's articles in this book. And indeed, the title, Exiles from History, is a Stein creation, as will be seen. Around the same time, I developed a relationship with a young woman who was completing her BA at the University of California in Los Angeles. She and I lived together for 6 months, and at one time were engaged to be married. She studied psychohistory under Professor Peter Loewenberg, and I therefore took considerable interest in her reports of the classes. I was disturbed that Dr. Loewenberg had condemned the Journal of Psychohistory in class on the grounds that it was run by laymen. He much preferred the Academic Psychohistory Review. Loewenberg apparently felt that just because the journal called itself that and appeared academic didn't necessarily prove that it was. Why, there was even a Journal of Historical Review which claimed the Holocaust had never happened. Anyone could start up a journal and call it whatever they liked. I was also somewhat shocked at Loewenberg's reaction when my friend, during a discussion, brought up the subject of the revisionist authors like Dr. David Butts. Loewenberg dismissed the Butts book, cross-quoting from other revisionist authors. He claimed to have read the book and was supposed to be fully conversant with its thesis. It was obvious that Loewenberg had not read the book at all. Otherwise, he would not have made such unfounded claims. But her remarks must have made some impact on Dr. Loewenberg. The next day, at the IHR offices, we received a book order from Butts' book from Dr. Loewenberg. I determined to learn more about an academic who would blatantly deceive his students like this. So I attended a lecture with my friend at Psychoanalytic Institute in West Los Angeles, where Loewenberg was hosting a semi-public lecture one night. The speaker's subject was the Holocaust, but Loewenberg's introduction turned out to be far more interesting than his quest. He claimed that he could detect all kinds of Freudian neuroses among the Nazis. For example, their fixation on excrement. Why else would they have literally turned millions of Jews into excrement? The audience of the students in psychoanalytics didn't even bat an eyelid. They might have been the only person in the room to ponder, or I might have been the only person in the room to ponder on what kind of academic mentality could fantasize human beings turning into excrement, for such a thing is not scientifically or pathologically possible. I gained a greater insight a few minutes later when Loewenberg took a kind of commercial break to say that, of course, all the horrors of the Holocaust only served to underline the continuing need for a secure state of Israel as a refuge for the Jews. All in all, my unacademic study of Dr. Loewenberg's academic ethics and behavior was most interesting. But there was better yet. A few months later, I traveled around the United States to visit all the various professors and contributors to the JHR. I talked with Lloyd DeMosey in New York and stayed with Dr. Stein and his wife in Oklahoma City. I was stunned to learn that Dr. Loewenberg had originally been on the editorial advisory committee of the Journal of Psychohistory. Then, when they had announced that the theme of their forthcoming special issue was going to be Judaism as a group fantasy, Loewenberg immediately resigned. He couldn't even wait to see the articles in question. I was fascinated, at the same time disturbed by the phenomenon of a highly qualified professor with doctorates, if both in history, just a minute here, history and psychiatry. I'm not going to tell you just what just happened. You'd laugh your ass off. Anyhow, who would blatantly lie to his students, who could pretend that he had read certain books when he had not, who could condemn journals without mentioning his previous endorsement, who could use his academic privilege to peddle partisan political positions, and who could suffer from neurotic anal nightmares. In a way, this book should be dedicated to him, for it was the clinical Loewenberg case which first motivated me to seek an explanation for such behavior patterns. But as we shall see, the denial of reality, the seeking of refuge from facts, is a phenomenon to be found throughout Jewish life and Jewish history. This is not just an intellectual exercise. It is a field of research that might very well have consequences for the future of the world. As I write on Thanksgiving 1981, the sabers are being rattled around the globe for World War III. Well, we're getting there. Sensible folks in Europe and other places are protesting against this possibility. But this time around, unlike in the Vietnam days, American Jews are on the side of the warmongers. And just as Gentile supporters of the Vietnam War were vilified and ridiculed, today those Gentiles who support peace are being attacked. According to today's Los Angeles Times, 26 November 1981, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Richard N. Perle, believes that the European anti-war movement is the product of Protestant agents, angst. Perle, who is Jewish, drew a distinction between the Protestant Northern Europe, which has been the scene of massive demonstrations against the new NATO deployment, and the Catholic South, where he said support for the new weapons is solid. The difference, he said, is that the Protestants are suffering from angst, a gloomy, often neurotic feeling of anxiety or depression. There's no question it's angst, Pearl said. It's a sense of fear and anxiety. Troubled people, troubled governments, troubled coalitions. And it's happened before and will happen again. And I think it's a phase that we're all going through. We will have to go through it holding their hand. As we shall see throughout history, there is no people on the face of the earth more tormented by fear than the Jewish people. One of the systems of this phenomenon appears to be projection of it into others. Another symptom is the striking of an arrogant, patronizing attitude, such as treating non-Jews as little children who need to be held by the hand. The third most prevalent symptom, not evident in the above example, however, is a fixation on anal and sexual dysfunctions and disorders. You notice, boys and girls, how the comedians, the Jewish comedians, are always into toilet humor, almost all of them. My thesis focuses on three towering Jewish personalities, Karl Marx, Leon Trotsky, and Sigmund Freud. In my opinion, these three men have influenced the modern world in a significant and unique fashion. Their imprint is on a host of different aspects of society. My argument is that we can trace their behavior back to their psychology. I examine the modern manifestations of the movements they founded. I also examine three areas where Jews have a unique attitude: sexuality, power, and destruction, the last commonly known as Holocaust. I will argue that here, too, we can find significant evidence to suggest that Jews suffer from a tremendous sense of fear together with very low self-esteem. At the conclusion, I will offer a solution, or at least some hope that the Jewish exile from history will not end with the ultimate nuclear holocaust for all of us. Jewish genius has already given us nuclear energy, Einstein. Yeah, and he also urged FDR to develop that bomb as fast as possible, thinking that they would use it on Germany, but instead they used it on the Japanese. So as far as I'm concerned, Einstein, of course, I don't care what theory he came up with, was an asshole. Oppenheimer, the hydrogen bomb, Teller, and now the neutron bomb, Cohen, let us hope that the Jewish neurosis does not bring about the use of these horrific weapons. Just remember that it was Jews that were the forefront of developing these horrible weapons. Now, certainly whites, non-Jews working with them. But the Jews were at the forefront. You don't read that much about Einstein urging FDR to do a crash program of building an atomic bomb. And I know exactly why, because he felt that it could be used against Germany. Hated the country where he was evidently born and raised. Okay, let's see how much time we got here. Well, I'll read a little more from the start of the rest of the book here. This is Karl Marx. He goes through all of them, gives you a history of these people. Karl Marx was born on 5th of May 1818 in the Rhineland city of Trier. I've been in Trier, Germany, or Trier. It was a beautiful town, beautiful city. My uncle had been there, too, early on in the 40s and Second World War when he came through Trier with tanks. Well, I went there in a used Mercedes-Benz to have a few drinks, me and my buddies. His grandfather was Rabbi Mark Levy, who had gradually dropped the Levy and changed the M-A-R-C to M-A-R-X. Shortly after Karl's birth, his father too changed his name from Herschel Marx to Heinrich Marx. He also adopted the Lutheran religion, into which the baby Karl was baptized. Carl's father was an attorney who later branched into a career as an entrepreneur, chiefly as a moneylender. He defended the predominance of Jews in the financial business because, quote, because they had been barred from more social, useful occupations, unquote. Well, that's true. As on his paternal side, Mark's mother was descended from a long line of rabbis. She clung to the family's traditional faith much longer than her husband. She was to make a profound impression on her son Carl, who was the first son to survive through childhood. Many of her characteristics appear to be those of a possessive, manipulative, stereotypical Jewish mother. Carl developed a love-hate relationship toward his mother, and many Jewish commentators have sought to explain Karl Marx's gross anti-Semitic statements as a rebellion against his mother's manipulation. For example, quote, to begin with, Marx was a man who, unlike other Jewish sons, hated his mother. In his innermost roots, he had none of the reassurances of maternal love. The Promethean complex, we perceive, is basically different from the kind associated with a Napoleonic ambition. A Napoleon could venture forth fortified by his mother's love and supreme self-confidence. Marx, choosing Promethean revolt as his life's plan, a perpetual struggle against the gods, he always to be reenact a search for self-confidence, always seeking recognition as a god, always anticipating rejection. This world was always to be one of struggle because he never felt secure in love. Well, that is life, struggle. Marx's hatred of Judaism, otherwise inexplicable, was the outcome of an animosity towards all of his mother, all that his mother signified for him. His youthful essay on the Jewish question, 1843, was the confused argument of a man who hates his Jewish heritage so much that he cannot bring himself to say plainly that he supports political and civil rights for the Jews. Louis S. Furor said, Karl Marx said the Promethean complex in Encounter magazine, December 68, although somewhat sophistic and causistic, Marx also expressed equally vitriolic comments about Christians, Negroes, Slavs, rivals, and all. There is more than a grain of truth in his argument. Karl was almost certainly his mother's favorite. She called him her child of fortune. Her letters to him were addressed to greatly beloved dear Karl, or to dear darling Karl, and were signed your eternally loving mother. In return, he referred to her as his angel mother. Her possessiveness over Karl extended right through to his death in 1863. When Marx was middle-aged, when he was a university student, she would write him to remind him to have a weekly scrub with soap and water. And I've heard that about him. He used to hang out in that British London library, and they said he stunk to high heaven. He was dirty, personally very dirty. A piece of advice which, judging by the published comments of his associates, he failed to heed throughout his life. His drunken rowdiness was a source of maternal complaints from his university days through some two decades later. Upon his father's death, when Carl was 23, his mother argued that Carl should take up remunerative work and fend for the family he now headed. Carl reacted with indignation, suggesting in correspondence that his mother continued tenure on life was standing between him and the family fortune. His mother compounded her son's envy by steadily expanding her investments, even though she was poorly educated and could write only fractured German. Carl's correspondence with his mother increasingly became mere begging letters, and his letters to friends became callous speculations about how much longer she would live. when Engels' lover, Mary Burns, died suddenly in 1863, Marx expressed regret that it had been Mary who had died and not his mother. However, Marx's mother was not long in fulfilling his wishes, and on December the 2nd, 1863, she passed away, leaving Marx with a more than proportionate part of her estate. However, Marx had already borrowed enormous amounts of money from his banker's circle, and thus most of his windfall went towards paying off that loan. The rest was soon squandered. And we'll stop for today. We'll pick it up because we've got 40 close print pages here to go. So let's do something else for a while. One thing I was quite interested in, which is not talked about much, was Karl Marx's view of the coming Civil War. I believe it said there he died in 1863. Well, that was right in the middle of the war, wasn't it? But anyhow, some of the things he said about the South and the working people, I thought were quite good. He talked about the capitalistic, or I don't think he called it that. Maybe he did. Nature of the slave trade and the whole bit, and how it hurt the general population of the South, the white population of the South. And so there was no real middle, not much of a middle class in the South. I'm going to dig that out and read that for you one of these days. See, you've got to understand, you can't get all your information from one source. There's no one person has it all. And you can't be dissuaded by people who say, oh, don't listen to him, he's this and he's that, you know. If you do, you're not really researching history and the information like you should. You got to go wherever it's at and get that information from whoever's got it, if it's correct information, and use it. That's the problem with the right wing. It's incestuous. I mean, they go round and round yapping about the same things, and if anybody disagrees, they become outcasts. I mean, these guys that get a leader over there on the right, if he says something and you go up and say, no, no, that's not true, they bring down all their followers on top of your head. Instead of saying, well, that's a possibility. You've got your opinion. I've got mine. Let's go on from there. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. I think I'm going to go over and see how Max Kaiser's doing. I checked in on him a couple of days ago. He had a pretty good 15 minutes on there. Let's go find out what he's up to. Funny, he had Alex Baldwin on his show, the show I'm talking about. You know, I spoke too soon. There's two damn flies got in here. Okay, I'll get them. When I get them, I'm going to pull their wings off. What I laughed about while I was reading that in that book was... I had a fly strip up here, like I told you, and the damn thing come falling down, and it got on my arm, and my arm was on the book, and I had to shut down there and get untangled, man. So instead of catching the fly, it caught me.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Some say that Abe Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people all the time, and all the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all the people all the time. Had Abraham Lincoln lived to see the modern financialized neoliberal era, he would have seen how wrong he was. You can indeed fool all the people all of the time. He would have also seen that all the people had been fooled all the time and for so long because they were, in fact, frickin' fools. That's right. Fools led by an assortment of elected and unelected fools. Foolishly, this has gone on to create a confederacy of fools. We live in a paradise of fools. It's a fool's paradise. Stacey?
Well, Max, you started with a quote allegedly from Abe Lincoln. I say allegedly because, of course, there are so many quotes online attributed to our founding fathers. Most of them are fake. But that one sounds good. To introduce us to the Chief Fool, this is a quote from George Osborne this past week during the Conservative Party conference. He said, "It's the economy that builds houses. It's the economy that creates jobs. It's the economy that pays for hospitals. It's the economy that puts food on the table." So Danny Blanchflower, a former member of the Monetary Policy Committee at the Bank of England, his response to this was what utter gibberish this was that George Osborne said to the people of the Conservative Party. He said, "The economy doesn't do anything. It is just the sum of people and firms and how they interact together. Construction workers build houses. Firms create jobs. Taxpayers pay for hospitals. Workers put food on the table."
Well, you know, Danny Blanchflower is pointing to a certain circular aspect to any economic model, which should be within a self-sustaining terrarium of inputs and outputs, and it's foolish to say that any one aspect of it is contributing to the growth of the whole. I understand that. George Osborne, what he's trying to say there is that debt is driving the UK economy, debt puts food on the table, debt is driving housing speculation, debt is funding his re-election campaigns, and in fact, debt in the UK is continuing to skyrocket under George Osborne. The debt in the UK is heading to £2 trillion. The deficit is also increasing. The overall debt in the UK is more than 10 times debt to GDP. It's similar to Iceland before Iceland collapsed. So Osborne equates economics with debt. Why does he do that? Because his coterie of friends are debt salesmen, bankers in the city who make a living selling debt, and they give some of the money they make to George, either overtly or covertly, in his quest to become, like all those other banchmatas, a very wealthy debt salesman.
Well, in fact, Dwonga is one of the biggest providers of funds to the Conservative Party. And remember, there are big headlines across the Financial Times this weekend that all of these payday lenders are going to be put out of business. There's 400 of them here in the UK. Well, 396 of them will be put out of business within the next year due to new laws. Well, the one that will survive is Dwonga. So, in fact, we're only going to have four payday lenders left, just like we have big four accounting agencies, big four law firms, big four banks. Everything comes down to four big four parties here.
Four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, Dwonga is a survivor, and because they're one of the biggest contributors to the Conservative Party here in the UK, you end up with an oligopoly and of payday lenders. But let's be clear about something. Our show and Russell Brand and me being on Russell Brand and Russell Brand being on this show, we made a big stink about Dwonga being loan sharks and usurious no-goodniks, and they got their wings clipped. So that shows the power of this show and Russell Brand's show. Dwonga got their wings severely clipped.
Well, I also want to mention the fact that George Osborne did push, and also David Cameron, they pushed the fact that Help to Buy has been a success, and they're doubling down. They're going to give free homes to the certain people out there, certain young people, people under the age of 40. Certain of them are going to get 20% discount on homes. So I want to talk about the windfall economy, how windfall economics runs the UK, and that is suddenly wealthy, just as quickly broke. Be careful with that windfall. So instead of finding themselves in the lap of luxury, 70% of people who come into sudden money are broke within a few years. And it really, to me, epitomizes what the UK economy is compared to when I go to the United States and see a different sort of economy there. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But here it's the windfall economy, is that they have unearned gains on all this property. People don't work for a living here. Certainly not the people you see shopping out in the streets and spending a lot on food and drink and vomiting in the streets. These are people who have windfall economics, and they spend recklessly. And that's, of course, to George Osborne, makes the economy.
Well, who's the most admired person in the UK? It's the Queen of England. Who's the biggest earner of unearned income? Who's the biggest scrounger in the UK? The Queen of England. So it makes sense that the population of England and the other three countries, including Scotland, will emulate this scrounger class by wanting to speculate in the property bubble with unearned income generated by debt meisters. Let me point something out. The idea that an economy is driven by house price speculation is one theory of an economy that Osborne has. But look at an economy like Germany, for example, which is, by all measures, much more successful than the UK economy, and the percentage of house ownership there is almost 90% less than in the UK. They don't approach the economy by house price speculation. They approach it as manufacturing, output, export, and jobs and real wages. And they have the much more successful economy. They don't actually speculate on housing. The house ownership is very low compared to the UK, and yet it's the most successful economy in Europe.
So here we have the windfall economy. People don't feel like they've earned it. They hadn't worked for a living, so they spend it and they blow it all on an orgy of drinks at the pub. And yet, the revenues, the tax revenues are going down to the government because though they say there's a record number of people in work, there's a record low, wages are collapsing. Well, according to Bloomberg, pound drops below 160 as UK recovery loses momentum. The pound has had its biggest weekly drop in 15 months, sinking below $1.60 for the first time since November, as signs of UK economic recovery is fading, damped bets on higher interest rates. This is from Bloomberg. This is from the currency markets. The currency markets, by the way, are signaling across the board a major collapse. They're acting as if it's 2008 at the height when the markets were collapsing by 1,000 points a day. Well, the dollar, gold, silver, Bitcoin are all acting like that's collapsing, though the Dow is up still over 17,000 points. So somebody's lying. Here, the headlines, the Forex market thinks George Osborne is a fool.
Well, they're not going to raise interest rates, no matter how much they talk about raising interest rates, because you cannot taper, what they call tapering or raising interest rates, a Ponzi scheme. So that's not going to happen. It doesn't matter what Osborne says they might do. Or Mark Carney, remember a year ago he said we're going to raise rates. Then 6 months later he reneged on that commitment and said, no, we can't do it. He said if employment got to a certain level, we're going to raise rates. It got to that level. He did not raise rates. And once again, he's saying he might raise rates. And then he reneged again. He won't raise rates. And the same thing in the United States, same thing with the ECB, is lowering rates, engaging in more quantitative easing to account for the global Ponzi scheme. So there won't be any rise in rates. Where the pound is going is immaterial. You have the dollar, which is the inheritor of all of this hot money around the world, which is fleeing Europe, fleeing these various countries, and crowding all into the dollar, which is kind of the last place that is harboring the hot money class for how long? We'll see.
So here's a chart from marketticker.org, and it's looking at the U.S. employment numbers. Remember, 248,000 jobs were added. They're down to like 6% unemployment rate, they say. Well, labor participation rate, however, is only 62.7%, and that is the red line there. People who left the workforce and did not come back are actually driving the unemployment rate down in America. So you have a lot of precarious workers in the United States, and I like to call this, as people have already coined the term, the 1099 economy. So in America, when you file your taxes, you file W-2. If you have a job, if you work for a company that provides you benefits. If you're a contractor living precariously, you file 1099. This means you still pay unemployment taxes to the government, the federal government, but should you become unemployed, you don't get anything. And that leads me to this final headline, a secret of Uber success, struggling workers. Despite falling unemployment, wages are declining in the U.S., and yet the stock markets are booming, of course, because of the likes of Uber, TaskRabbit, Lyft, HomeJoy. And apparently the likes of HomeJoy, for example, the journalist here hired somebody for $19 to clean their entire house in Silicon Valley for $19. The young guy cleaning his house was homeless, living in a shelter. So in order to sustain this sort of frenzy of venture capital going into the likes of Uber and Lyft and HomeJoy, you need this sort of job environment where people are desperate to work for anything.
Right, but you can still maintain, through the advent of these new modern technologies, somebody who's homeless, we're heading into an environment where they can still maintain $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 of debt. So they can buy a smartphone, they can plug into an internet service and watch videos, they're on the street and they're eating garbage. But they're still, through the technology of the global banking system, they can, as long as they're maintaining $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 worth of debt, and consuming. They don't want workers. They don't want wages. They don't want capital. It's not capitalism. This is debtism. They want people in debt. They want them permanently in debt. They want them born in debt. They want to give babies in the womb debt through the umbilical cord, born in debt. They want babies aborting themselves to get out of debt. They don't care. It's all about debt.
Well, actually, Uber, because there are people so desperate, Uber is renting cell phones to their employees. they are also providing car loans to their employees to buy a car because they can't. They need a huge workforce in order to make this work. And in fact, to become ubiquitous, these companies need lots and lots of cheap contract laborers to serve customers who want them to be available at the push of a smartphone button. But there's a big vulnerability in all these business models. They wouldn't work if they had to offer full-time jobs with substantial benefits, and the reliance on contract workers to sustain this burgeoning market has become controversial. So $3.6 billion in capital venture funds have gone into these sort of companies in this year. So the venture capital, the VC money believes that this will continue, that American workers will continue to be 1099 contractors desperate for anything.
Yeah, well, the difference between feudalism today and feudalism of yesteryear is that the rickshaw drivers of today are wearing Google Glass, you know, which enables them to maintain their debt balance and chase all day for that magical pork bun at the end of the road that will sustain them for another day of debt increase. But other than that, it's still feudalism.
And finally, I'm going to turn to the Dow Jones, a chart here from 1975 to today. And you see it's like three peaks higher and higher and higher. That goes from 1975 to today. And I want to juxtapose this, take another look at this chart. And this is the chart of savings in the United States going back to 1975. So you see what has happened, the hollowing out of the 1099 contractor employee who used to have benefits. Their savings is also hollowed out. It's all gone to the top 10%, mostly the top 1% who own the shares in the Dow Jones. This is why we are, as Abe Lincoln said, of a nation of fools run by fools.
Get yourself a rickshaw and a Google Glass. Be part of this new economy. Stacey, we gotta go.
Well, that one had some good stuff in it, but the one before it, or the one after it, was better. So we'll play that maybe later in the week or next week. Well, some people are doing something, and this I give a lot of credit to the guy on this recording. You'll hear he's in a commissioner's meeting, and they try to push him around, and he pushes back. Let's listen to this.
Not on the agenda.
That's unacceptable.
We're adjourned.
That's unacceptable.
You can go outside.
No.
We're fixing to have executive.
That's unacceptable. That is taking the right of the people to voice it.
Dangerously close to disrupting a public meeting.
This public meeting's been adjourned, so I can get as dangerously close as I want. You're not
the
king. This isn't going to operate under tyranny. The people have a right to have their voice heard, period. You left off public comments because you didn't want to hear from the citizens, and you're going to hear from me. You're going to hear from me. You're not going to silence us by your abuse of power.
Will you take this man out of the courtroom? I'm adjourned for executive.
I am breaking no laws. I am breaking no laws here. I am breaking no laws. I am not leaving. You are going to hear our voice. You are not going to abuse your power. No, I'm not. I am not leaving.
And now the cop comes on the scene.
Removed from the court. I'm acting under the Georgia's.
I'm not leaving.
From the court.
I'm not leaving.
Now the cop grabs the hold of the guy.
It's not going to make any difference. Let's go.
Come on. Thank you, Fritz. Appreciate it. Thank you, gentlemen.
Hey.
I thought that might have been a mistake, but apparently it wasn't a mistake, huh?
What's that like?
And y'all commissioners that are standing by allowing this, y'all are cowards. All of you.
Come. Please don't make me use force on you.
If you can tell me a law I'm breaking, I'll be happy to comply.
A law is breaking. You were given an order to be removed from court. Now
you are violating the Constitution, and it's your job to uphold the Constitution.
My job
you
is to
are.
Follow
you are abusing your power.
Get out of the chair.
I'm not resisting.
I'm asking you to come outside. By you not following my lawful order, you are resisting arrest. Do you want to go to jail for resisting arrest? I'm asking you a question.
Hold my phone.
Why don't you want us to talk, Fred?
We got business to tend to. We're not. This isn't no political stomping ground. That's all you want to do is
you just keep believing that. You just keep believing that.
Come on. That's fine, but you
have I'm a good man.
Meeting when we go in executive session. That's the law.
We can talk afterwards.
I promise you we'll be coming back because your abuse of power is not going to stand in this county.
Whatever.
You bit off more than you can chew.
Yeah, whatever.
Now you get more and more people into these public meetings and raising hell from different sections of the crowd. You can bring them down. That's one thing. That's one thing that can be a lot of fun. Because they trample on every privilege you've got and think they can get away with it, and then they call the big fat cop in to drag you out. But 99% of the time, they drag you out and release you on the outside anyhow. But they're just, you know, just like this political meeting I went to the other night, there wasn't any passion. There was nobody there really pissed off and screaming and yelling and giving them hell. And there's plenty of things to give them all hell for. This passive sheep stuff is ridiculous. But there's still a lot of people out there that'll fight, and that makes me feel good. Well, guess what? I got a big story here for you now, man. I'll tell you. Oh, boy. Down there in Nigeria, there's a lot of nigger Christ insanity preachers getting very wealthy. The country's Pentecostal churches are booming, which have become some of the largest gatherings of believers in the world, as well as some of the richest. Although these mega churches have always enjoyed tax-exempt status, recently they have come under the attention of the government because a building collapsed and killed 115 people, mostly from South Africa. The building in question was owned by T.B. Joshua, the pastor of the synagogue. Well, wait a minute. I got a problem here. Well, here we go. This building was owned by the Synagogue Church of All Nations and one of the richest spiritual leaders in the country, and his church collapsed. According to the article in Forbes magazine, Joshua is estimated to be worth 10 to 15 million bucks as preacher, and is only topped by two other ministers in Nigeria, the first being the Bishop Winner's Chapel, which estimated net worth of 150 million, and the second, Chris Oyakhilome, pastor of Believers Love World Incorporated, has about 30 to 50 million. There you go. See, they've caught on. The American religious crooks have taught these niggers well. Despite Nigeria's gross national product now being in the region of $510 billion, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, these mega-rich pastors don't contribute all that much to the economy because they are classified as non-profit. This means that they are categorized by the NBS as other services when it comes to Nigeria's gross national product figures, which only came to 2.5% of the total GNP. According to Bismarck Rawani, economist and CEO for the Lagos Financial Derivatives, no one knows how much these pastors are really worth because they don't submit accounts to anyone. He added that at least six of them have private jets. Telling you, don't get into the stock market, young man. Get into religion. Become a fake phony. Well, they're all fake and phony. But get into those churches, man. You can make a fortune. It's easy. Even Johnny Clary, the ex-wrestler, ex-KKK member and all that, he couldn't do anything right. He got fired from every job he ever had. But now he's running around with Jimmy Swaggart making all kinds of money. It's a perfect job, and you don't have to have an education. You don't have to go to college. You don't have to go to do anything. Just be a big bullshitter and lie your ass off. One preacher, I can't even pronounce his damn name, this nigger, is also a favorite of Nigeria's politicians and owns a 10,500-acre campus just outside Lagos called Canaan Land. During a celebration for his 60th birthday last month, Akinwumi Adesina, Nigeria's Minister of Agriculture, said that everything Occipito touched turned to gold as he looked around the vast campus, which can accommodate over 250,000 nigger worshippers. Oh, wow. A fool and his money are soon parted. Well, there were several stories this week about Christ insanity. AIDS-infected stealing pastor has refused to step down from his church. Pastor confesses that he stole money, used drugs, had AIDS, and slept with the church members' wives. Former elder of the TD, Jakes, I don't know what that is, says he was escorted out of a building for writing his book, whatever that is. Ex-wife of meth addicted, rape convicted, mega church pastor speaks out. Let's see what else we got here. Ex-wife reveals gospel star Dietrich Haddon's adulterous past. Let's see here. Well, that's it. But there's hundreds of these stories every week about the con job of Christ's insanity and synagogue insanity and Islamic insanity. It's all insanity. You just laugh at it if it didn't affect you. But it affects everybody else in the country because these people vote right down the line with Christ insanity politicians, or they pretend to be Christ insanity, and that you end up picking up the bill. I think that all churches, synagogues, or whatever, mosques should be taxed. And I think that when churches get so big, they're taking in billions of dollars, it's gotten way out of line, man. Way out of line. Tax the damn churches. Last figures I had was here in this little county I'm in, fairly little, tens of millions of dollars are going out of this county every year to Africa and Asia and all over the world down these rat hole cesspools in the third world through these missionaries and so forth. I'm telling you, if you had a decent government, it's time to break loose from this kind of stuff. But you got to have the balls to stand up and say what needs to be said. You can't be cowardly and chicken shit. Don't let them tell you how peaceful they are and how they love their neighbor and all that. Most of these wars have a basis of Christianity, Judaism, or Islamics. The Abrahamic religions are bloodlust people. And if you don't believe it, cross them. Well, boys and girls, that's it for now. We'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. And in the meantime, be a lone wolf. You know, you're going to get farther running by yourself. The time will come where you got to form a pack. But for now, keep silent. Keep your submarine at periscope level. And shut up.
The state fair ended on a sour note last night after yet another outbreak of violence. And today, police fear that a string of assaults may be race-related.
Two officers were injured and five people were arrested last night, marking the third time that a large group of young black people were involved in assaults in or around the fairgrounds.
We had reports that these juveniles were attempting to assault white citizens.
What we've got to realize is that there is a war going on right now in which people are being killed between the white Christian West and the Jewish-led colored hordes of the earth who are rising to slaughter and murder white people under the banners of communism.
We have to exterminate white people off of the face of the planet to solve this problem.
Our borders are wide open. You have 3,000 illegal immigrants coming across the border every day.
We have an aging white America. They're dying. It's a matter of time. The explosion is in our population.
It reminded me of Paul Revere when he was saying, you know, the British are coming, the British are coming. Well, the Latinos are coming, the Latinos are coming.
You can't stop us. There's too many of us. We're ready. We're breeding by the day. You think we have kids because we like sex? No, we're having kids ready to start this war. Believe me. I got another one on the way. She'll be strapped up, ready for you. Come get it. We're ready. We're ready. I say, Mutapi, I say.
Change has come to America.
Supporters packed Grant Park by the tens, if not hundreds of thousands, to watch America elect its first black commander-in-chief.
Leave it to Beaver. Father knows best. That America does not exist anymore.
Kirkland is accused of killing Esme Kinney. He's a registered sex offender, already wanted on other charges.
Barnes confessed to stabbing 16-year-old Megan Landowski inside her home back in 2008.
When Megan came home from school, Robert surprised her, sexually assaulted her, then stabbed her 40 times.
Gang members threw a white victim through a door in Lodo. He walked up to the white male and without provocation punched him in the face.
A teenager is killed during what appears to be an attempted carjacking.
They are members of two different street gangs that came together to assault, beat, and rob mainly white people they found walking alone.
The murders of Shannon Christian and Chris Newsom.
According to the 46-count grand jury indictment, Chris Newsom was repeatedly gang-raped while Shannon was forced to watch. The assailants tortured Newsom, shot him, and set him on fire. The attackers then tortured Shannon, gang-raped her, poured bleach down her throat to destroy DNA evidence, and murdered her.
Newsom's body was found bound and burned. He was shot at least three times. Christian's body was found a few days later in a nearby home. Her body had been stuffed inside a large trash can in the home's kitchen. And the race of the suspects, black on white.
The victims were white, and all five of the accused are black.
The national news media, they say, spends plenty of time covering white on black crime, but has completely ignored the story here in Knoxville.
Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, the other two tools, they won't do their job. They won't tell you what's actually going on.
The suspect's name is Christopher McEwen. He was arrested early Saturday morning. The sheriff's deputies found the body of 21-year-old Janice Shearer in McEwen's pickup truck. Inside the house, they discovered one of the victim's ears in a pot on the stove and another piece of flesh nearby.
The police this evening confirmed the identities of the five victims, Edward Gentry Sr., Edward Gentry Jr., his wife Pam Gentry, their son Jeremy, and Jeremy's girlfriend, Kristen Warnicki, all shot and killed on November 12th.
When they arrived here around 3 a.m., the home was engulfed in flames and all five people on the property were already dead.
23-year-old Jeremy Pickney and 23-year-old Samuel Conway were arrested in connection to the brutal murders. 22-year-old Marvin Stringer was shot and killed by authorities Thursday night after investigators attempted to serve a search warrant.
This is not some random tragedy of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Whites are murdered all the time because that is what the people who created the system want to happen. That's why we focus on the Jews and the system they built rather than whichever nigger it happened to be who carried out the murder. Niggers are a known entity. They're a wild animal that attacks and destroys white communities. So the people who sick them on us, who let them out of the cages, are the truly guilty ones. Those are primarily the Jews.
I do think that a very great number of people in America are very uncomfortable with the fact that we are changing, and changing in a fairly radical way demographically.
You need to make sure your child can speak Spanish.
The Census Bureau has predicted that in the year 2050, white Americans will lose their majority. We are, for the very first time in our history, a genuinely multiracial democracy in which no one group predominates. Not whites, not Protestants.
It's genocide against white people. It's Africa for the Africans, Asia for the Asian, white countries for everybody.
We've had 40 years of gunpoint coerced integration, and Shannon Christian is the result. It is the fruit of integration.
It's genocide against white people.
We're having kids ready to start this war. Believe me, we're ready. We're ready. I say, Mutapi, I say.